Hello, I'm Keith Perron. This is number 0118, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0118. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Rebecca Dakin, who is a former escort who has written the book The Girlfriend Experience. How does an English ex-convent girl turn into a high-class escort?
I did have a very good upbringing, but I didn't fare so well when I went to university. And I think I just wanted a get-rich-quick scheme. So I decided to venture into the dark side and to try escorting. And I actually really enjoyed it. So what I thought was going to be kind of a couple of years while I sorted my life out and decided what to do ended up really, in effect, becoming a career and lasting for 9 years.
Actor Barry Livingston, best known for his role of the youngest son on My Three Sons, is the author of The Importance of Being Ernie. What made him write his story now?
The trajectory of my life has been such that I had this great fame early on. The middle part was kind of a downer, not necessarily like catastrophic, but you know, I mean, I was out of work and had some issues with some substance abuse things, nothing catastrophic or something I couldn't control myself eventually. And then I rebounded, put my career back on track, and, you know, luckily I've been working with people like Robert Downey Jr. and Brad Pitt and Katie Holmes. So, you know, it was an interesting trajectory, and I thought, hey, you know, there's a book there.
Carl Zimmer is the author of Science Inc., an illustrated collection of hundreds of tattoos that scientists have. How did he get interested in scientists' body art?
It really just came totally by accident. I happened to notice that a neuroscientist from Harvard had a tattoo on his shoulder one day, and I complimented him on it. It was a DNA tattoo, and I said, oh, I guess that makes sense. You study genes in the brain, so you've got some DNA in your shoulder. But it turned out that there was much more to the story. He had actually encoded his wife's initials in the molecule on his tattoo, and so he explained to me this intricate system he had done to do that. So it got me thinking, oh, I wonder if there's some kind of hidden subculture of scientists who are putting their science on their skin.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0118, is Keith Perron, host and producer of The Happy Station Show, which you can find on PCJ Media. You could also find The Stuff File on PCJ Media. You can check out their website at pcjmedia.com. And, of course, you can find the links on my website at thestufffile.com. And thank you very much, Keith, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the news, shall we? Well, we all know pregnant women can often get some pretty strange cravings. But 42-year-old Alison Brearley of Yorkshire, England, takes it to a whole new level. The professional artist and taxidermist, yes, that's right, professional artist and taxidermist, says she has cravings for, wait for it, roadkill. I'm not kidding. So she's been eating pheasants, rabbits, and pigeons, pretty much anything she finds dead along the side of the roads of her hometown. In the past, she's often used roadkill to make jewelry from their hides, but now she's found a new use for the dead animals. Allison says, it's more gamey than other meat, and I love the taste. I also don't have to feel guilty about eating it because I know it's had a completely free-range and natural life. Yeah. Any guesses on what her unborn child will grow up to be like? Okay, this has to be the worst wife ever. Amber Hersey of Laurel County, Kentucky, has been arrested and accused of trying to hire a hitman to kill her husband, who was a disabled Iraqi war veteran. Now, Mrs. Hersey allegedly offered to pay the contract killer life insurance money she would receive when her husband, James Hersey, was killed. Her big mistake was trying to hire a killer, and I'm doing air quotes here, who happened to be friends with her husband. So he told Mr. Hersey, who then called police, and they set up a sting operation to trap his 28-year-old insane wife. She was caught on tape making incriminating statements about the murder plot and has now been charged with solicitation to murder. Former soldier Hersey said he was in the middle of a messy divorce from his wife, well, messy is the understatement here, when he was told about her alleged scheme. They were separated after 3 years of marriage, and he was living with his grandparents. Mr. Hersey says, "I'm actually terrified. It was all too unreal, like I was in a movie." Despite being caught red-handed on tape, Amber is pleading not guilty. You know, I was almost going to make her the idiot of the day, but she's a combination of stupid and evil, and I'm not messing with that. Idiot of the day, by the way, comes a little later on, though. Now, if the deer ever rise up and take over the world a la Planet of the Apes, they will point to Fort Wayne, Indiana as the birthplace of the movement. 62-year-old Fort Wayne resident Paul J. Smith died after a deer he had been hunting extracted his revenge. According to the Department of Natural Resources, Smith called his son shortly after 9 a.m. and left a message that he'd shot a buck. When Smith's son returned the call around 10:30 a.m., Smith told him that after coming down from his tree stand to field dress and tag the deer, he discovered it was still alive and that he scuffled with the animal before killing it with a knife. Smith called park officials by cell phone at about 12:30 p.m. to request help in transporting the deer to the reduction hunt check-in station, but a park employee who went to retrieve the deer found Smith unconscious and seated next to a tree. The park's property manager and an off-duty conservation officer tried to revive him with a portable defibrillator and CPR, but got no response. Medics arrived and pronounced Smith dead at the scene. An autopsy showed lacerations on his liver that were in line with internal bruising that doctors believe he received when he scuffled with the deer. Now, do the deer now get a chance to mount his head somewhere in the forest? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder, talk about a bad habit. Sister Marie Thornton has narrowly avoided jail after admitting to stealing around $400,000 to gamble in slot machines at casinos in Atlantic City. She submitted false invoices and arranged the Iona College in New York to pay her credit card bills. The college has clawed about half of the money back from its insurance company. Thornton admitted stealing over 10 years and said she was deeply sorry for the embarrassment caused to her religious order and her family. A judge ordered her to complete 2,000 hours of unpaid work and pay back about $150,000, saying it appeared that she has been rehabilitated. As an act of contrition, the nun now spends her days and nights in solitary confinement in a small room inside a Philadelphia convent. You know, not to stereotype the Catholic Church or anything, but the punishment she got is in some way less than some women in some religious orders do in their regular days. I mean, 2,000 hours of unpaid work? Living in solitary confinement in a small room? To some nunneries, that's luxury. Anyway, while we're on the topic of nunneries, let's kind of get to our next guest. There's a link. Kinda. Here we go. Rebecca Dakin is an English ex-convent girl turned escort and subsequent author and businesswoman. She has an understanding of what men want and shares her experiences in her book, The Girlfriend Experience. Rebecca joins us via Skype to Skype communications from the UK. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. The first question right off the bat, based on the introduction, how does someone go from ex-convent girl to ex-escort?
Oh, well, yes, that is quite a jump, isn't it? I think, well, I I did have a very good upbringing, but I didn't fare so well when I went to university. And I think I just wanted a get-rich-quick scheme. So I decided to venture into the dark side and to try escorting. And I actually really enjoyed it. So what I thought was going to be kind of a couple of years while I sorted my life out and decided what to do ended up really, in effect, becoming a career and lasting for 9 years.
And what made you finally get out of it?
It was just, it's the type of business, Peter, where a lot of girls get stuck in it and some say they're going and then they come back because the lure of the money. And you kind of get to the point where you think, what else could I do? There's nothing else I could do. And I just thought, if I don't force myself to finish now for some other reason, I can just see myself carrying on and on and on. And I just didn't want to do that. I mean, no disrespect to girls that are working in their 40s and 50s, but I just didn't want to do it personally myself. I wanted to be very successful in another business before I settled down and had a family, and that's why I kind of now came, I wrote the book, that was the closure, and set up my business as a dating coach, and yeah, putting my energy into that. And I'm actually realizing now that there are other ways to make money without having to go down that route.
So was the transition after that 9-year period difficult, leading to what you are doing now?
Yeah, it was difficult. It was just, I'm very strong-minded, and just something switched in me. I think I knew I wanted to finish doing the job because I found that I was getting less tolerant of people, and I was starting to not enjoy it. And I'm not the sort of person that can do work that I don't enjoy. So when it got to that stage where, you know, I felt that my tolerance was, you know, was wearing thin. I just thought this is a sign for me to kind of wrap this up now. So I wrote the book, as I say, that documented all my experiences, which is also very therapeutic, just kind of trying to figure out and psychoanalyze myself. Why did I end up choosing that sort of profession after having such a good upbringing? Yeah, I waffled so much now, I can't remember what the question was.
Okay, so let me ask you this. You've written this book now, The Girlfriend Experience. Who exactly did you write it for, men or women?
I actually wrote it for both, Peter. I think what happens is that when you're in that sort of profession, and it's the same with a lot of things, you do get put in a box. There's no sort of grey area. It's just like, right, you're an escort, you're a prostitute, you're this, you're that. And I wanted people to show that actually, you know, it's easy for people to understand when they think, oh yeah, men just pay for sex. But when, you know, men actually pay quite a lot of money for companionship. And I just really wanted to show that other side of escorting, that there actually were very successful, very nice gentlemen that did treat me like a lady, that wanted to, you know, pay for companionship, and, you know, would go away to different countries and little countryside breaks and things like that. And that actually, that's a really, really big business. And I think it just that misconception that men just want sex, I just wanted to show that actually that's not true. So it was for men, it's for women, it's for women who might think that their guy's cheating, or if they've not had an intimate relationship with a husband for a while, they should definitely read it and find out some tips as to how to spice things back up again to avoid their men going to see escorts. Also, I think women are just generally nosy, aren't we? We like to know about different sorts of this sort of profession. And men, I found that men have enjoyed reading it, just because, again, it's a sex trade. It's something a little bit titillating. So, it's suitable for both men and women, I found, reading it. Also, girls are really thinking about going into the business should really read it, because it shows how I went about going, becoming an escort, but also shows the pitfalls as well and the dangers. And I think girls going into it need to know, you know, not just all that, not think it's all glamour, that they need to be aware of the other side of things.
And we should mention that you were what is considered a high-class escort. You're not the type of woman who would be standing next to somebody's car window in an alley, correct?
No, definitely not. I wouldn't even, Peter, I wouldn't even, if somebody called me up to meet me on that evening, I wouldn't meet them. It was my plans, and my diary was booked in advance, weeks in advance, sometimes months in advance. And that was how I did it. I wouldn't even class myself as a call girl, really. You couldn't just call me up and just say, I want you to come round and see me. It didn't work like that. It had to be planned, and it had to be planned in advance. I wasn't that sort of.
Okay, well, there are some places in Europe where your former profession is something that is legal. In most of the Western world, it is not. Do you think it should be?
I think it should be, and it is actually legal in England. I was self-employed, registered with the tax office as a self-employed escort. What's illegal is to make money off of moral earnings, so agencies and things like that are illegal. But yes, I do believe it should be made legal. I don't know what it's like in Canada, but it's certainly in England, you find that the girls, it's very dangerous. They're all into drug use. They're not protected in any way. And they get abused. And I just think if they could legalize it and monitor it and let them have houses to work in, the streets would look tidier, the girls would be safer, and everybody would be, you know, benefit from it, because you're never going to stop that profession. That it's always going to exist. Sex always sells. And I think, you know, really, it happens. It's always going to happen. So why not try and make it as safe as possible for people?
So you offer nowadays an online dating workshop which teaches men how to optimize their online dating profiles, correct?
That's correct.
So
yes.
So what's the biggest
I love doing that.
So what's the biggest mistake men make in this category?
For their online dating profiles, they're normally they don't say enough about what they've got to offer, and they don't specify enough about what they're actually looking for. And they don't seem to think about what they're saying. They have this idea of this woman that they want to attract, but it's not, their profile is not tailored to attract that sort of woman. So I kind of revamp their profiles and word it in a way so that they attract the women they want to attract. And also men sometimes get a bit lazy with it, and they don't really say much on the dating profiles. I mean, you have to get it spot on. You have to have the right photographs. A lot of them are using the wrong photographs. You know, there's pictures with them with a pint in their hand, drunk out with their friends, or there's the cutout girlfriend one where you can see a woman's hair next to them. They make so many mistakes with the photographs and the profiles, and they're actually really nice guys. There's nothing wrong with them. They'd absolutely get dates, but it's just that their profiles are not quite right. So I love kind of working with them and revamping them and giving them advice for you on how to contact women. A lot of guys generically contact women. They just blast an email out saying, "Hi, like the look of your profile." And it goes out to so many women. You know, and I advise them that you always address the woman by name. You must actually put something in the email that says that you've read the profile, something to start a conversation going on. So it's personalized. I'm really excited about it. I love doing the dating profiles.
It sounds like the old story of what people always say, what women always say about men, that men aren't necessarily the greatest communicators. Is the problem with doing what you do that sometimes when you spruce up someone's online personality that it's not really who they are?
No, I'm very careful when I do it, because there's no point in me writing my words. So I actually work with them to actually use their words. And through communicating with them via email, or if we're doing Skype coaching, I can get a feel for their personality. So I don't, there's nothing false on the profiles. I don't make people something that they're not. I just make sure that they maximize, and they, you know, their qualities are there and they come through in their profile. So it's just a matter of making sure that what they've, a lot of guys aren't really aware of what their qualities are. And a lot of the time I spend time, it's a bit of self, it doesn't dawn on them. They've never really thought about it, and then when they get told that, oh yeah, I am actually really caring, or you know, they just have that light bulb moment when they just start thinking, yeah, I'm all right actually. So I think a lot of them have suffered from a lack of self-belief, a lack of self-confidence. I really kind of get them to think about the good things they've got to offer a relationship. And that helps with the confidence.
You're also working on your second book, Why Husbands Stray.
Yes. Ooh. Yeah, I'm really excited about this book as well, because it's women want to know why men cheat. And, you know, obviously there's a certain amount that they can get from the girlfriend experience. But this is actually stories from cheating men. So it's like trying to get blood out of a stone, getting men to talk about their feelings, isn't it? And the how and the why. But I am getting some really fascinating stories. So they're anonymous, obviously, but they're actually real life situations from guys. And it's talking about, you know, how they felt about their wives, what the family situations like, when they decided they were going to cheat, how they chose to cheat, how they felt afterwards about the fact they cheated. Did they feel any guilt? How the relationship with their wife had actually improved, or if it had got worse? And I think it's really be exciting book for women. Very insightful.
Well, the current book is The Girlfriend Experience. When you finish doing Why Husbands Stray, will you come back on the program and talk about that?
Oh, of course, Peter. I'd love to.
And I got to ask, as a former convent girl, after all you've done and now the popularity of what you're doing and the website and the books, have you heard from any of the sisters?
No. I've not been asked to join the nunnery just yet. But please do ask them to have a look at my website. They can get a couple of chapters for free, download them as PDF via my website, and I actually ship. They can buy copies via the website, and I will ship anywhere in the world a personalised copy. I can inscribe something for them, and it's all available at thegirlfriendexperience.tv. And my website is RebeccaDakin.com, and they can find out about my date coaching and all the other bits I do on there.
Excellent. I thank you very much, Rebecca, for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to speak to you.
Rebecca Dakin, author of The Girlfriend Experience. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0118, and you'll find links to Rebecca's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to actor Barry Livingston, better known as Little Ernie Douglas from the television series My Three Sons. Also, Carl Zimmer, the author of Science, Inc. That's all coming up. And, of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. And here's your pro tip of the day. When returning your rental car, it's best not to forget about $500,000 worth of coke you hid in the vehicle. Seriously. Last year, San Jose psychologist Charles Preston bought a pristine condition 2008 van from thrifty car sales in Santa Clara. He considered it to be a great deal at $14,000, and the only issue was the door windows would not roll down all the way. Well, it turns out that they didn't for a very good reason. It's because those doors were crammed with several kilos of cocaine worth about $500,000. Preston didn't find out until about 15 months later. When a mechanic went to fix the window problem, the coke was immediately turned over to police, who told him something rather chilling. They told him, take the van back into the repair shop to check for tracking devices because somebody is probably looking for it. Then get rid of it. When Preston tried to return the Coke mobile to the thrifty car sales, he was only offered current trade-in value, about $10,000. Preston said, "It took me a long time to save up the $14,000 for the van. I should get what I paid for in trade-in value." When the story hit the press, Ron Battistella, who is the owner of Thrifty Car Sales, suddenly stepped up and is now willing to replace the van with a drug-free ride. You know, those are the kind of stories you never see depicted in car commercials for dealerships. Ever. In Conroe, Texas, 30-year-old Howard Keith and 44-year-old Tina Marie Ari were arrested after police found them with dozens of hydrocodone and soma pills. They were also with an unconscious third male that Keith later admitted he had given some of the pills to. So anyway, Keith and Ari were then put in handcuffs and in the back of a patrol car. But on his way back to the station, the arresting deputy noticed the pair moving around and then could no longer see Tina in his rearview mirror. She told the deputy that she had put her head on Howard's lap because she was tired. However, when the deputy pulled over to the side of the road, he could see that despite both parties being handcuffed behind their backs, Howard's pants were undone and Tina was servicing his exposed genitals. So the deputy ordered them to cease the sexual contact and then continued driving them to jail. There were no additional charges. I'm surprised at that fact. There were no additional charges, but anyway, there weren't. And boy, if they ever get married, years from now, they can share that story with their kids and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. Ah, good times. Yes. Anyway, need more proof that meth is bad for you? In Morgan Hill, California, police say 38-year-old Henry Arnabal was high on meth when he killed, skinned, and then ate a wild bobcat. Arnabal was also found to own a stash of sharp cockfighting ankle spikes and about 50 roosters. The story is that the large bobcat had eaten five of Arnabal's roosters, so he killed it with a .22 rifle. He wasn't charged with eating the bobcat because that's not illegal. But killing one without a permit is against the law. Plus, there's the whole cockfighting thing and the drug thing. Police were actually looking for a marijuana farm in the area when they stumbled upon Arnabal's trailer and the rooster pens. Deputies alleged the roosters were being raised for cockfighting, perhaps in the Philippines, but there wasn't enough evidence to prove that. The roosters were taken away by animal control authorities. Gee, I wonder what wine goes with bobcat, by the way. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Tennessee said a man arrested on a domestic assault charge admitted to throwing a ham that struck his mother in the back. Union City Police said Brenda King, age 55, told officers her son, Emmanuel Cordell Kennedy, age 37, threw an object that struck her in the back while she was walking down the hall during an argument. Officers said Kennedy admitted to throwing the ham and said he was not expecting his mother to be walking down the hall at the time and had not meant to hit her with the meat. Kennedy was arrested on a charge of domestic assault. Okay, this is a difficult story for me because, well, I love ham. And even if he didn't expect his mother to be walking down the hall at that moment, why in the love of God would he be throwing good meat like that around the house? I mean, who does he think he is? David Letterman? Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Barry Livingston is best known for his role as Ernie in the classic 60s sitcom My Three Sons. He's a true Hollywood survivor who has continued to work as an actor into adulthood. He's written about his experiences in his new book, The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. Barry joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Barry.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. And I got to mention, I love the title of the book, The Importance of Being Ernie.
Yeah, well, occasionally we get it right. That one just seemed to be a natural.
You've written this book now. You've been an actor basically all of your life. Why now for this book?
Well, you know, I did the show, My Three Sons, which is what I'm best known for playing Ernie. I had reached an anniversary. It reached the 50-year mark, which in itself is stunning. A half a century is crazy. So that was in my mind. And then, you know, I've had so many experiences with people, real showbiz icons, you know, from yesterday, people like Jerry Lewis and Jackie Gleason and Fred McMurray and, you know, Lucille Ball. And I've told stories to people over the years, just, you know, just things that happened, just interactions between me and Elvis Presley, people like that. And they said, oh, these are great stories. You got to write them. So I thought, yeah, you know, and then the trajectory of my life has been such that I had this great fame early on. The middle part was kind of a downer, not necessarily like catastrophic, but you know, I mean, I was out of work and had some issues with some substance abuse things, nothing catastrophic or something I couldn't control myself eventually. And then I rebounded, put my career back on track, and, you know, luckily I've been working with people like Robert Downey Jr. and Brad Pitt and Katie Holmes. So, you know, it was an interesting trajectory, and I thought, hey, you know, there's a book there. You know, that was really the impetus.
Well, let's go back to when you first went on to the series My Three Sons. You'd already been a veteran of television for many years at that point. But and you joined My Three Sons in the third season, and I'm just kind of curious, was it kind of weird playing the adoptive brother of your actual blood relative brother?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, it wasn't obviously a big stretch for me to perceive him as my brother because we were brothers. But, you know, I originally came on, you know, as a friend next door. That was my first entry into My Three Sons. I played Ernie Thompson. And, of course, when Tim Considine decided to leave the show, and he was the original oldest son, Mike, they needed, you know, somebody to make the show Three Sons again. And I was, luckily for me, kind of hanging out in the bullpen waiting for that call. So, yeah, you know, I didn't even, when I first came on the show, they didn't even mention that I was, you know, a foster child. You know, that came to light around the time they needed somebody to be adopted into the show. So it was, you know, not a strange dynamic because my brother and I had worked on a couple other shows before. We did some stuff on the Ozzie and Harriet show, and in fact, we even played brothers on my very first film. Was a film called Rally Around the Flag Boys with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. So, you know, it was fun. That's the best way to put it for me off the set. And, you know, people certainly bought it that we were brothers, that's for sure.
Having gone through the Hollywood system as a child actor, when you work today, I'm sure from time to time you have the opportunity to work with kids today. How different is it for kids in Hollywood to work now than it was when you were a kid?
Well, they're, you know, I mean, I guess the anytime you get a lot of money and you're a kid and you're famous, you're, you know, it's a sort of a recipe for a potential disaster because kids, you know, are not fully informed on the dangers of fame and how you can, you know, be tempted with a lot of vices that people will be offering to you because you are famous and you certainly have the means to acquire them. There wasn't so much of that when I was a kid. I mean, probably the worst case scenarios were parents that were not really looking out for their kids and maybe using their money, you know, the kids, the money that they're making, instead of putting it away and saving it, you know, it was being squandered on luxuries that once the kid arrived at a point where he should have had some money, around 18 years old, he found out he had no money. So, you know, those are a little bit different, you know, but the process is pretty much the same. You know, you're a child actor, you go to the set, you do your scenes, you get famous, you know, and then again, you just got to hopefully have people looking out for you.
In today's world, we have Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and the tabloids and TMZ. If that kind of stuff were around when you were a teenager growing up in television, would it have been more a difficult situation? I mean,
well, you know, my mistakes I made out of sight from the press and the public, you know, and that's just the nature of being a teenager. You're gonna mess up, you know. I mean, what teenager do you know that, you know, hasn't crashed his car, hasn't had an accident, did something crazy, got drunk, did, you know? I mean, honestly, it really it's unfair to hold kids who are famous today to such this incredibly a standard that nobody could meet when you're that age. Granted, you know, people have some pretty spectacular crashes, but, you know, it's I was lucky. You know, my mistakes that I made them, and like any other teenager who's not famous, you get past them, you move on, your parents are mad at you for a while, and you go on and you try to correct your behavior. But, you know, when your behavior is held up under such a microscope and broadcast on every television set and newspaper showing your picture at the supermarket that you've really screwed up this time, you know, that's got to mess with your head. I feel sorry for some of these kids today. I really do.
Did you really have the opportunity to enjoy what you were doing when you were a kid? And by that I mean, was it work? Was it fun? Did you realize just how lucky and fortunate and, yes, talented you were to be able to do what you were doing as a kid?
Well, I did enjoy it because the people I worked with were a lot of fun, and they I think they had me very at their best interest. I mean, certainly they wanted me to be a contributor to the success of the show and were happy that I could do that. But I think they also cared that I wasn't exploited. I didn't really go on any giant publicity junkets, and there was no Gurney dolls or, you know, any kind of merchandising based on bobbleheads, you know, or anything that I had to go out there and hawk for the TV network. So, you know, my experience was pretty natural, I think, you know, as close to a normal childhood as you could get in that awkward kind of strange environment of being famous as a kid. I used to go back to public school every year. You know, I had friends outside of the industry. You know, my parents turned down a lot of work when I was on a hiatus because they just wanted me to go back and have a relatively normal childhood growing up. So, I think all of that, they were all good decisions for me.
When you look back almost 40 years later, more than 40 years later, when you look back at either reruns or DVDs of My Three Sons, what do you see? Do you sit down and watch the show and enjoy the story for what it is, or are you thinking about what happened on the set or how you put that scene together? Do you get to enjoy the show like the rest of us did?
Yeah, I think I do enjoy it more objectively. You know, there was a time when it was on, it was, you know, a little bit strange to watch those shows, and, you know, and then the show has gone through different perceptions from the public. You know, there was a time right after My Three Sons went off the air, about 72, that it was considered to be, you know, this selling the public with some fake, unrealistic values of what an American family or any kind of family should be or could be. And, you know, it was just, they were saying, oh, it was a big lie that, you know, that problems are solved in a half an hour. Well, you know, as it's at, over the years, you kind of get past all of the politics and the changing cultures, and suddenly you just look at it objectively and you go, you know what, it was just a simple show, family-oriented, you know, small problems within a nuclear family, and dealt with it with some comedy and wit, and that's nothing more, you know, than really what they were in the 60s. But sometimes it takes a little distance, and I see them as being very funny. I mean, they're funnier than I ever thought they were when we were doing them. They were very well written, very well produced, and had great stars involved with Fred McMurray and William Demers, William Brawley. So, you know, they're pretty quality. They really are. They've held up real well.
I've had the opportunity to talk to several child actors or former child actors, and they seem to be in two camps. Those who wouldn't mind if their own kids went into the business, and those who would not. Where are you in that?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Where are you in that?
Yeah, well, I would probably not encourage my kids, but if they wanted it, you have to want it. You just really, really have to want it. That's the only way to get into the business, because you're it's hard to encourage your kids to go for a future that's just loaded with rejection, you know, just loaded with ups and downs and just tremendous pitfalls of but, you know, the upsides are wonderful, you know. I mean, the money is good, the fame is not a bad thing to have in your corner, you know, the hours, you're treated well, you see the world, you know, if you're a movie star. You know, there's some great things associated with it. So, yeah, but, you know, that's all I would tell my kids. I go, I'm not going to get you an agent. I'm not going to help out. You know, if you want it, you better go get it. Because I think that's, you got to prove to me that you want it. And number two, you know, I don't want to be in the position of feeling like I got you involved in it, and then perhaps you have some, you know, horrible reaction to it, and then I feel guilty that I pushed you into it. So, you know, if they want it, they can go get it, and I would certainly support them.
but it's not, you know, it's not important to me or to you know, go out there and push them into this business, because it's pretty crazy. It's pretty fraught with a lot of dangers, and I don't want to push that on my kids.
How and when did you know you wanted it?
Well, I knew it pretty early, you know. I mean, I hate to say, I probably knew it, you know, by the time I was 10, that I really liked it and I enjoyed it and was getting a lot of positive feedback. And then, of course, I went on to, you know, series. Like I say, in my early years, I was working with people like Debbie Reynolds and David Janssen and, you know, Lucille Ball. And, you know, these are the stories in the book that I try to go through and talk about my experiences with Dick Van Dyke and being on his show. So by the time My Three Sons went off the air, you know, I was pretty serious about becoming a really good actor. And I went to New York, worked on Broadway. You know, have a lot of stories about the New York theater and working in at Kennedy Center in Washington and doing plays in New York and the theater world after that. So, yeah, I knew it pretty, you know, certainly by the time I was out of the show, I knew, okay, this is a career for me. I think I could make this work. And luckily I was getting some jobs. So that's, you know, that's important, because you know, as good as you can be, you have to have validation that the people that hire you have the belief, that same belief, that you're going to be an asset to their project. And so, you know, I had enough of that to keep me going.
The book is called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. It's written by Barry Livingston. And Barry, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Actor Barry Livingston. Once again, his book is entitled The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0118, and you'll find links to Barry's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With America celebrating Thanksgiving, children in schools across their nation will be learning about the first pilgrims. One thing they often learn is that if it hadn't been for Native Americans, the pilgrims may have never survived. In the years since then, though, the relationship between Native Americans and those who arrived here after them hasn't always been so happy. From the Trail of Tears to modern-day trials over whether sports teams should use tribal names, it's often been a rocky road. Recently in North Dakota, one tribe even sued a college to force the school to keep its Indian nickname. Let's be fair, some disputes should be decided in court, but many others shouldn't. One member of the tribe that's suing the college strongly opposes the lawsuit and said the money being spent on lawyers could be better spent on things like housing and medical care. And she's right. While we should be thankful for our courts, we should also remember that there are many ways to peacefully resolve disputes other than expensive lawsuits. Find out more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the author of Science, Inc. Plus, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But I have one more Stuff File story I want to get to before we get to all that. And before I get to the Stuff File story, just a quick mention. In the last couple of shows, we've had a couple of really big guests on Michael Learned, who you may remember from The Waltons. She was on the program 2 weeks ago. And also George Chakiris, the Academy Award-winning actor from West Side Story. He was on the program just last week. And I have also taken those two interviews and added pictures from those two fine actors' careers and put them up on YouTube as sort of a slideshow to accompany the audio that goes along with it. So if you want to take a look at that and hear the interviews, if you didn't hear them on the show, and see them with the accompanying slideshows, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0118, and you'll find links that'll take you to the page that will take you to the slideshow, which is on my YouTube page, which the link's always there on the website anyway, but a special link to this particular one will be in for this week's show, so you can check that out. Okay, let's get to the Stuff File story. The last one before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Teresa Mejia, held in a Burlington, Washington police station on kidnapping charges, climbed through a ceiling vent in a dramatic escape attempt traversing the entire length of the building before officers knew where she was. However, that put her directly over the police chief's office, and she crashed through the floor. I gotta tell you, if this girl didn't have bad luck, she'd have no luck at all. Now, I know she's a criminal, but she should get at least a few points for style. That's all I'm saying. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Science journalist Carl Zimmer is the author of Science Inc. It's an illustrated collection of hundreds of tattoos dedicated to the scientific arena. And Carl joins us on the line right now. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. How did this interest in documenting tattoos in science come to you?
It really just came totally by accident. I happened to notice that a neuroscientist from Harvard had a tattoo on his shoulder one day, and I complimented him on it. It was a DNA tattoo, and I said, oh, I guess that makes sense. You study genes in the brain, so you've got some DNA in your shoulder. But it turned out that there was much more to the story. He had actually encoded his wife's initials in the molecule on his tattoo, and so he explained to me this intricate system he had done to do that. So it got me thinking, oh, I wonder if there's some kind of hidden subculture of scientists who are, who are putting their science on their skin. And so I asked a question on my blog, and suddenly I was being inundated with these pictures.
Now, were you very, very surprised? Because, you know, the general population, and again, you know science, you are a journalist, you talk about it, you write about it, but the general population has this idea of scientists being this kind of nerdy group of people, and tattoos are not something you would associate with that group at all, regardless of what the tattoo is.
I suppose, you know, a lot of us have a kind of stereotype in our minds of scientists as being, you know, unemotional people in white lab coats. But, you know, the fact is that scientists are actually quite passionate. And, you know, they really do love their research. I mean, it's what gets them through their long days and nights of work in the lab and other places. And so, you know, after a while, it sort of occurred to me, you know, this actually makes a lot of sense.
Did you find out in doing your research that scientists are aware of other scientists with their tattoos, or was it just something that they each individually did on a whim and it had a scientific background to it?
Yeah, it was actually quite funny that there were lots of scientists who would email me and sending me a picture of their tattoo and say, you know, I can't believe that all these other scientists have tattoos as well, and I want to share mine too. And so there was this sort of community that kind of emerged from the shadows just thanks to this basic innocent question I asked.
So you mentioned that one scientist had the DNA on his shoulder. What are some of the other scientific tattoos you've come across, and was there any commonality in any of them, or were they just as different as the scientists themselves?
The range and the diversity of the tattoos is what really impressed me. So, you know, the book Science Inc. is actually divided up into lots of different scientific disciplines. So there's a mathematics section, there's an astronomy section, there's a physics section, there's a neuroscience question, there's a technology section. If you can think of a branch of science, I can probably show you a tattoo from it.
Since there is a certain amount of surprise in that this is done, have you actually talked to any tattoo artists who may have done scientific tattoos on clients to find out what they have to say about it, if anything?
Yeah, I have actually talked to tattoo artists about this, and from what they say and what the scientists say from their own experiences, I gather that it's been really interesting for them because, you know, you'll have some scientists come in and, for example, we'll have an equation, a very complicated equation that, you know, he wants on his back. And so they'll get to talking because, you know, it takes a while to get a tattoo, so there are hours to spend just chatting. And so, you know, the scientist will explain, for example, you know, this is an equation that explains general relativity. And, you know, the tattoo artists, you know, really come out of it, you know, having actually learned something. So it's been a really interesting coming together of these two cultures.
Is there anything about the placement of the tattoo that says something about the scientists involved? Are they all visible, like on a shoulder, or are some hidden away? What have you found out?
There are, you know, a fair number of people who, you know, keep these tattoos in a semi-private place, you know, on the shoulder or on the back or, you know, on their foot. There are some cases where people have wanted to, you know, not interfere with their chances of getting tenure, perhaps. and then other people who just don't care and they just let it all hang out.
The book Science Inc. has, I understand, over 300 tattoos. At what point, from the time when you posted the blog question to the idea that you were getting a book, what was the span of time, and when did you decide, you know, there's more than just a blog here?
It went on for about maybe 3 years before I got to talking with a book designer who I know, and we started to think about the possibility of turning this into a book. You know, by that point, there were so many tattoos that I had posted on the blog that I just totally lost count. And, you know, there were just more and more surprises that would come to us. So we just decided, hey, let's do this. And so that was last year. And so we reached out to all the people who had emailed me tattoos and have them send me much higher resolution pictures, and then we, on my blog, I invited other people if they wanted to send something to me, they could as well, and then we basically selected from those our favorite ones, and then I, you know, went about actually explaining the tattoos. You know, there's a story behind every one, whether it's the story of the scientist who carries the tattoo, or maybe there's a story about what's pictured there in the ink.
We should mention that your blog is called The Loom, that's L-O-O-M, and also your website is carlzimmer.com. Now that the book is out, are you hearing more from members of the scientific community saying, yeah, you know, I've got a tattoo also, or my husband has one, or my wife has one, and they're a scientist, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's definitely been a resurgence of emails. I'm getting a couple just about every day now. New, you know, scientists are saying, hey, here's mine, and attaching a picture. So I have no idea how many science tattoos there are out there. Maybe I'll just need to come up with a second edition eventually.
Well, I was about to ask, would a second book be coming out?
Who knows? We'll see. I mean, at this rate, you know, I'll certainly have enough images for a second one. You know, it's getting to the point now where it's almost like the cycle is looping back on itself. So now there are people who look at the blog or look at the book, who are scientists themselves, and get so inspired by it that they decide they're going to get a tattoo that represents their own science, and they get it, and then they email to me and say, hey, look what you inspired me to do, and then I post that as well. So, you know, the loop is completing.
Well, I was just about to say that maybe we're going to be reaching a point where someone is not going to be afraid of hiding a tattoo to get tenure. They might get a tattoo to get tenure.
We'll see about that. That would be an interesting shift of the culture. But perhaps we're already on our way.
The book is called Science Inc. It's written by Carl Zimmer. You can check out his website at carlzimmer.com. And Carl, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Carl Zimmer, author of Science, Inc. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which again is show number 0118, and you'll find links to Carl's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Brent Morgan, age 20, was arrested in Prince George, British Columbia in October on 3 counts related to an attempted theft of a Corvette. Morgan had seen the car in a driveway, jumped in, and locked the doors. However, the owner had been in the process of charging the battery, which was still too weak for the car to start and for the door locks to continue working. Feeling trapped and sensing that the owner had called the police, Morgan panicked and began using any available tool inside the car to smash the window. According to the police report, officers arrived just as Morgan had broken open the driver's side window, but too late for Morgan to realize that he could have exited the car by manually lifting the door lock with his fingers. Yeah. Why couldn't he just turn around and unlock the door with his hands, you ask? Well, one reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0118. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you can find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0118. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.